I'll just very briefly introduce the company and where I'm coming from. So you know, I'm a sort of an industry, which is a way of saying it's I don't have anything of intellectual content to deliver. Julius is a small company we founded last year, and I guess what we're trying to do is provide analytics to the correlation markets, pricing of CDOs, things like this, and we're trying to put together the first, we think is the first sort of fully coherent model, which is internally consistent, and prices pretty much everything you want to do in the correlation space. And I'm aware that many of you are quite well versed in CDOs and credit modeling in general, but I'll, for those of you who are not, I'll just give a very quick introduction to that might motivate the rest of the talk. So put simply, a CDO is a company that doesn't do anything. It's the simplest conceivable company. It comes into existence. It will go out of existence after a fixed period of time. It will do nothing except purchase corporate bonds or otherwise gain exposure. At the end of the period, it will wrap it up, and that's it. So why do these companies exist? Well, it's kind of a long story, but in short, they exist because the mere capital structure of the company makes it interesting enough. This is a way of selling risk to people who might want different levels of exposure, people who might have certain restrictions on what they can buy, what they're willing to buy. If you're an equity holder in this company, you'll receive quite good returns on your investment. If you're a mezzanine debt investor, you'll receive slightly less returns, but you'll be subordinated to the risk. And so it goes up to the top level. So to oversimplify things to some extent, a company buys a bunch of bonds. If at the end of 5 years all the bonds are in good shape, everyone's very happy. If they're not, the company's liquidated. Of course, the senior debt holders get their money back first, and so on down to the equity tranche holders. So if there have been some defaults, the equity tranche holders lose. There are a lot, the mezzanine tranche holders lose, and so on. It goes up the scale. Now, the constituent securities which enter into these companies are often traded in the market. We know what their price is. We can back out very easily what their probabilities of defaults are. And so this game is entirely one of trying to understand the dependent structure between defaults of different companies. So this is a problem that's been around. I guess these particular markets have exploded since perhaps the early 2000s. Some of the earlier attempts to model these instruments have had various flaws, and the existing methods also have many flaws, but it is an example. I'm not going to say where this type of model comes from, if you're not careful, you get various bizarre effects happening in the way you value your structured products, including the fact that you could include irrelevant assets that reduce the overall risk. What we're trying to do at Julius, just to introduce the company, is come up with an internally consistent credit model, which means, in a concrete sense, ability to generate default scenarios, recovery scenarios, spread scenarios, and so forth, across the full gamut of beginning with investment-grade corporate credit, in such a way that we hit the prices of every traded tranche of every synthetic CDO or basket default swap, if you prefer to call them that, and every credit default swap in the market. That hasn't been done. It's been looked at in many banks and many hedge funds, I'm sure. At least I'm not aware it's been done. And the obvious application is to try to put a value on bespoke or custom CDOs, which clients like. But there are many other applications here, and I've hinted at some of them. Great interest right now in counterparty risk assessment, particularly looking at monoline exposures, things like this. There's an interest always in looking at reconstituted securities, CDO squared, CDO cubed. There's no end to the manner in which you can recycle structured products, but without sort of a coherent model, you can't do a look through in a sensible way, and all sorts of other applications. So, in any case, that's just a kind of a brief introduction to what we're doing. I'll cut short some of the stuff that looks more like investor material, but unless, of course, there are investors in the audience, talk afterwards. The main challenge here is are very well known. There are many constraints. If you have, for example, 300 different credit default swaps, let's pretend that they're liquid at the three or four different maturities. They're not really, but that's 1,000 constraints. And let's assume that you have liquid markets for tranches, CDX, iTrax, some other portfolios. And again, the liquidity is somewhat in question, but nonetheless, if you have educated guesses about what these numbers are, then you have a pretty complicated jigsaw puzzle to put together. So that's the challenge. And of course, the market standard for many years has been the normal copular model, which I'll discuss briefly. Tom was asking where we are. That's where we are. If you ever get stuck waiting for a train at Penn Station, you're bored, come up and pay us a visit. I've lost the talk. Sorry. We transferred the talks to USB drives right before. It'd be interesting if I actually managed to delete it from my actual computer. No, we seem to be in luck. So, let me give a little bit more background to this particular little snippet of a talk that I want to give today. It's been obvious to everyone for many, many years that the industry standard model for correlation products is inadequate in many different ways. Spent years giving talks internally and about all the horrible inconsistencies of the normal copular model, and many of you are familiar with them. It's not internally consistent. There's no dynamics to it. The updating of spreads contingent on defaults looks highly suspect. One can go on and on and on about the sort of problems with it. For those of you not familiar with the basic model, we could chalk and talk a bit, but in essence, if I begin with a multivariate normal distribution and I simply consider one of the coordinates and I map that onto some other distribution, coordinate by coordinate, then I'll get a some other multivariate distribution with different marginals. And that distribution is said to possess, let's say, the dependent structure for the normal copula. Another way to think about it is that a copular function is simply a multivariate distribution on the cube where your variables have unit marginals, and you could achieve that by rolling a multivariate dice and then mapping back to uniform, coordinate by coordinate. It's a very simple model. It has the compelling advantage that if you specify the marginals, or the, if you like, the one-way relationships for your variables and the two-way relationships and with the correlation, then you're done. Because, of course, you're mapping back to a multivariate normal distribution. If you know the covariance, that's it. And that's really why it's been used. And there are many, as I said, there are many critiques of the normal copular model. So the first question is, why am I sort of beating a dead horse? Well, there are several reasons for that. The first is that it's still in use, predominantly. Almost every vendor product, almost every bank, every hedge fund is using this. And another reason is that models which are ostensibly not the normal copular model can actually be quite close to it due to the kind of contagious nature of copulas. Any monotonic transformation in variables is going to leave you with the same dependent structure. So whilst you might have various bells and whistles and in a structural model, for instance, it will almost invariably have the same dependent structure often. Another reason I decided to look at this was this particular exercise was that it occurred to me that almost all the models which are used to value, you know, the trillions of dollars of exposure in the credit markets, at least I wasn't aware of terribly many cases where they've actually been used for anything else, which you know the answer. There's never been a single realization of the credit world, let alone sort of 5 million of them, with which to infer the correlation structure. It seems to me that perhaps these models have existed because they, they have this kind of privileged and protected existence. You can't probe them, right? Perhaps perhaps during some soul searching or something on a recent flight back from Sydney, I decided that I would have to actually try these models out on something, even if it was completely irrelevant to credit modeling. And another thing that had been bugging me was that all of the sort of fast analytics that you really use in industry, starting with the simple stuff like, analytic pricing for a single factor model for your basket of default swaps, things like this. I built all these things for Morgan Stanley years ago, and you always have these implicit assumptions in the back of your head, which are that go something along these lines. They say that, first of all, working from the bottom, assumption being if you know the correlation structure of what you're looking at, then you're in pretty good shape, arguably, and you can do Monte Carlo, whatever. That's an assumption I'll question during this talk. Secondly, if you have a three-factor model, that seems pretty good. I don't know why three factors, but it just seems, you capture a lot of the covariance and the variables and so forth. But integrating out three latent variables, whatever, is time-consuming as well. And so in practice, in industry, one-factor models. And so it goes. Anyway, there's belief that you can just exploit this sort of conditional independence or rank reduction or whatever you want to call it. And I just wasn't quite sure that that was really necessarily true. There's no way to verify it in credit because we'll never have enough data to know. It becomes a philosophical question. In some respects, although the fact that these simple models don't fit the market would tend to indicate that something may be askew. So I ask you the following questions. If I look at whether it rains or not in 10 different locations on the East Coast, how many factors do I need for that? What rank reduction is reasonable that I can get away with? If I wanted to, for whatever reason, price combinatorial bets on how many days it would rain or in which particular locations, whatever. I don't know. Does anyone have any strong opinions? I certainly didn't going into this. I was just curious. And of course, another obvious example is equity. If you look at equity price falls of, for instance, large cap companies, it's kind of a topical thing to look at, I suppose, then how many factors do you need to model 10 companies, or 100, or 1,000? And of course, there's plenty of papers written about this. About how much of the common sort of variance you can capture in various measures. But my question was not could I capture sort of 98% or something of the R squared. It was if you did capture almost all of the variation or you thought you had, even with a pretty good factor model, what happens to your combinatorial bets? What happens to your bets on will there be four out of 10 defaults? Will 5 out of 7 companies take a big hit today? And does the accuracy of one translate to the other? So anyway, here's just some data I started to mess around with. Part of this exercise also was to experiment with what I would call instantly reproducible research. You can go online, if you like, to financialmathematics.com, and you can literally cut and paste six lines of code into your MATLAB browser and the whole thing will run. It's also instantly improvable research, because there's probably something wrong with it and you can fix it up for me if you like. Here's what we see. If we were just to follow the usual prescription, and I'll sort of illustrate through this, you know, how this model is applied in practice, then we might do something like this. Here's the binary correlations between rain. Easy enough to back those into Gaussian correlations in the normal copula model. And then see how it predicts. Here's a random example. I've taken six different locations. I have fit my the normal copula model, and I'm going to bet on whether there'll be three, four, five, six different locations in which it rains on a given day. And we're done with the normal copula model. We're done. I gave you the correlation matrix. We know the marginals. Easy. That's it. Go home. There's one answer. Except there isn't one answer, because the data says something else, at least for the three-factor model, which is considered reasonable. Here's some more examples. So we played around a bit more, and the one-factor model is even worse, and the six-factor model still, it's okay, but it's getting there. And anyway, the full-rank model is actually pretty good, turns out. Don't diss the normal copula model completely. It might be useful for predicting rainfall. And sorry? It's not a factor model. It's something completely different, which I'll get to in my next talk, maybe. there's a green line here that's sort of a point of comparison, but it's just another broad brush approach that I was using to create these pictures at the same time. I merely want to illustrate that there is some model that does better than copula model. 10-factor examples and so forth. So if there was a liquid market for CDOs based on whether it would rain or not in these particular 10 locations on the East Coast, then I think the normal copula model would do a pretty good job. You might have a pretty flat correlation curve. The base correlation would probably not go above 100% as it is currently for the senior tranches, and everything would be fine. Possibly. I don't know. Or maybe there's something wrong with my code. An example of the normal copula model in captivity in a reproducible system, or at least one which has enough data, probably, 4,000 days. That's about 4,000 times as much data as we really have for corporate defaults over any sort of stationary horizon. And of course, I'll just fly through the next example, which is equity prices. I looked at this example because I was sure that it would work. After all, you've got large cap stocks. Implied dependence structure in almost any sort of portfolio management system that ever gets used is probably normal copula or very close to it. Companies are so big that you would hope to get the law of large numbers on your side. And the data set's quite rich, back from 1960. If we look at daily changes, we should be able to do okay. So here again, we're simply looking at whether any of these 10 companies takes a 1% fall in their equity price on any given day. Pure binary exercise. And the reason I'm making it a pure binary exercise is so that you can at least match the pairwise behavior. It's enough degrees of freedom, the marginal. You can change the correlation until you hit the binary probabilities exactly, as we do here. And there you go. It's not bad. Surprise, surprise, the dependent structure amongst equity is pretty reasonable. Although, what did surprise me was that if you start trying to play rank reduction games and model it with models which are more amenable to rapid analytics and the sort of things you might use on the credit side for pricing the analogous products, then it doesn't seem to do very well at all, which troubles me a little bit. But in any case, here are some sort of summary statistics. So I'm looking at various different approximations to the full rank matrix here, I'm looking at the average pricing error on each of these combinatorial bets. Here, my state price is simply the security which pays $1 if there are four defaults out of seven. Call them defaults. Four drops in stock price out of seven. And there's 120 possibilities, and we price them all under the model and take the average of the worst percentile. See when, how badly this model misfits when it does misfit. And what we find is that there's just a pretty, it's kind of what you would expect in some ways, just a quite well-behaved approximation as you increase the number of factors. So, no great surprises there. And so if you reduce the number of factors, you could be in trouble here, but nonetheless, I think it's another example where the normal copula dependence is not too bad. Now, of course, if you believe in structural models, that would imply that the dependent structure amongst corporate defaults should also be the normal copula model. Certainly, for a fixed horizon, if you're just interested in the binary event, will the company default or not? If your assets or equity or whatever it is log normally distributed, then you've probably got a pretty good case here. However, it's by no means evident that the structural models are in fact accurate. We've seen plenty of anecdotal evidence in the last week or two that the debt and the equity of a company can behave in quite different ways, particularly for equity holders of Bear Stearns, for instance. And we came very close to what many people think was a major meltdown in the financial system, and had Bear Stearns gone under, it's quite possible that Lehman Brothers and some other firms might have gone under. And certainly, people close to the business were deeply and profoundly concerned about this, and there's quite radical action by the Federal Reserve in the end to try to stave off disaster. But if you look at a lot of companies out there, particularly specialist companies, the reinsurers are particularly interesting, credit derivative product companies, and others who are highly leveraged into the credit markets, then it's not in any way a priori clear that their dependent structure of default is going to be the same as the dependent structure you would get if they are all modeled by Brownian motions which happen to be correlated themselves. I just don't buy that. The market doesn't buy it in terms of what you see in prices for the securities which reflect this dependent structure. So I wanted to try to suggest a different analogy, and look at a system which where you have very direct and explicit kind of knock-on effects here. And I was thinking to myself, what is a decent repeatable system? And so to and sort of some sort of penance for my modeling sins over the years, I decided to force myself to undergo some repetitive experiments to gather data, and on a rather long United Airlines flight, I started playing a freeware bowling simulation game and recording on napkins the exact pin count that remained at the end of every bowl. Because the dependent structure amongst the pins that fall down is quite complicated, it's very interesting to see whether the broad brush approaches that you see used in institutional finance everywhere can work on this simple example. And again, the prescription is the same. you know what the marginals are if you bowl enough frames. I ended up getting some other people to help, and we compiled 4,500 frames and recorded the positions. And of course, you know the individual pin probabilities, and let's suppose I tell you what the probability of the 3 and the 10 pin falling down is, and for that matter, every pairwise probability. So we'll assume we know those exactly, which of course you don't know in the credit markets, but here I'm giving you the 1 marginal and the 2 marginal precisely. And I say to you, we're going to bet on, in this case, which of the following pins will fall down? The 2, the 3, the 5, the 7, the 8, and the 10. What is the probability of 3 of them falling down? Well, the normal copula model makes some predictions. To say that they're inaccurate is possibly an understatement. It is simply not the case that the 1 and 2 weight relationships amongst pins extrapolate in the correct manner, at least the way I was bowling on the game. Maybe if you play the game you might get different results, but it simply does not extrapolate out to the n-way relationships here. And I'm sure there's many different statistical ways of looking at this. I'm not much of a statistician, but no matter how you slice it, and which examples you look at, it was pretty much rejected out of hand. And that's with a full rank matrix. So there's no real reason to look even at the one factor and the two factor models. Although I wrote up some results for those, and they're online at financialmathematics.com as well. And so the question is, well, why are the results so bad? And you know, one response is, well, this is a bit of an unfair example, right? And there's some strong asymmetry in the pins here. That's just completely unfair. But I would say, okay, well, fine. Let's take the pins and sort of symmetrize them. So every time you bowl, you randomly choose one of three directions and you rotate the pins and you mix the results together. That ought to help the normal copula model fit the answers. And it does. It helps a little bit, reduces the errors, but still significantly off. And I'm sure there's other copulas we could try out, sort of taken off the shelf. But my instinct here is that if you actually want to capture knock-on effects, then it would be extremely difficult to construct a copula which captured that behavior starting with the 1 marginals. And I can't help but wonder, and I'd have to open this up to discussion, but I can't help but wonder whether in this case that kind of philosophy of, first reduce it to some distribution on the unit cube and hope that you can find that, is in any way helpful here at all. Question? Yeah. So there's, I've been a bit brief here with the numbers in order to drive you to financialmathematics.com where I have all the code and everything and it's reproduced. And I tried to get the wireless here to work, but I can't show you many of the numbers here. But it of course depends on which combinations of pins you get, and you can play around for a bit and you can easily come up with ones that are particularly bad. If you look at the correlation structure, it's going to be pretty tricky for the model to fit. And of course, it depends on the way I was bowling as well. The way I was bowling was I'd sort of bowl slowly and badly, but try to hit at least one pin. That was the algorithm. And I think that leads to sort of negative correlation, you notice, between the 7 and the 10 pin, perhaps, and things like that. That was just one example I pulled out. This is motivated by research to come up with much more flexible ways of modeling dependence. And Been working hard on that, but it's unfortunately the research is way too immature to present at this point. But I'll show you one last example. It's just kind of using as a testing ground for more flexible dependence structures than the copula families. And that is the Rubik's Cube. So in this example, we start with the Rubik's Cube in a solved Rubik's Cube and pick 10 different squares, maybe 9 from one face and one other random one. And I make five random moves with the cube. A random move is any normal turn, and then with some much lower probability, some rotation about one of the three axes as well. So that way, even if you choose the middle face of the cube, there's a chance it will get moved. And then the variables of interest here are the binary variables, 10 of them, which simply record whether or not the square ends up on the same color you started with. No particular rationale for this example. It's just an interesting joint distribution for the binary random variables. And I thought it was maybe an interesting test case for, you know, allegedly flexible copula families, for instance, see whether they could fit this. And again, I don't have much time to work on this, but the my suspicion is that even with some fairly elaborate copula families, this particular example might be challenging. And actually, this I think the normal copula model does a little bit better in this example, perhaps, than the bowling pins. But it's still quite a challenge. And the code for simulating the cube and all the rest of it is online if anyone's interested in using this as a test case for anything. I put some summary statistics here because I thought they were kind of interesting, although they may be only as interesting as the bugs in my factor approximations, I'm not sure. Is the one case where you don't get monotonic behavior in rank reduction. So for whatever reason, the three-factor model works better than the other factor models here. And works better than some, almost as well as some more sophisticated techniques. So, in any case, these are my sort of tentative conclusions at this point. After sort of almost 6 or 7 years in industry, building a bunch of things which were, you know, close to this particular dependent structure, I feel a bit sheepish that I never bothered to test it on anything in the real world, anything in captivity, anything that's actually a repeatable system where you know the answer. And the very first look at this suggests to me that there could be some problems here with there could be some serious problems with risk management, just generally speaking. Unless you subscribe to the view that unless you're a really strong sort of Merton disciple in the sense of believing the dependent structure in the equity market translates to the debt market. But I'm not convinced of that at all. It seems to me that kind of the 10-pin analogy is perhaps more closer to reality sometimes, at least, than the Merton analogy when it comes to looking at the dependent structure. And it troubles me that the default industry standard model behaves so incredibly poorly on this example. Anyway, I'll leave it at that for now. No great sort of observations here, really. I'll just mention very briefly one other thing, and that is just where you can find the rest of the paper and the results and the code and all the rest of it if you are so inclined. This is something like we did early last year. It's a little bit of an experiment in collaboration, and reproducible research. And all we've done is take the MediaWiki software and built it out to include all the bells and whistles, including some of the things I'll show you in a second. But this has become a depository for code and stuff that we use all the time. And it's convenient. It was created basically because we became very annoyed with the speed of collaboration and passing zip files around and things getting out of version control. And having worked in industry and having nice source control and everything for years, but at the same time, one of the things I did in industry was manage kind of an outsourced project, all the academics and so forth. It became very tough, and so, you know, having now started a company which does a lot of outreach as well, we decided to try to fix this up. This is our suggested solution, the objectives are that you can just immediately make a contribution, immediately fix something, throw in code, do whatever you want. The way it works is quite simple. Simply enclose, in this case, MATLAB code in MATLAB tags. It gets syntax highlighted, gets automatically rolled into version control, and there's a simple utility as well called FMUs, which means you never actually have to have any of the code lying around. I can send you two lines of code, literally. You can cut and paste it into MATLAB. It will download everything it needs on the fly and just run. So in any case, if you're interested in this particular sort of nascent empirical work or where we've put this stuff or what we're doing with it, then hop on and have a look. Unfortunately, we've been attacked already by hordes of the web's robots, so you'll have to log in and get a username and all that sort of stuff. I'll leave you with this free advertisement. This is an example of the contributions we've received. some bot came along and lobbed this thing on us. And I checked it out, actually. It's pretty interesting. You can buy it online, and it does really shoot at your colleagues and things like this. Anyway, we'd love to receive contributions of more intellectual weight, if possible. Anyway, so I'll open up to questions and leave it at that.